You probably know Samantha Power because of her impressive resume. Her work as a war correspondent, her Pulitzer Prize, ambassador to the United Nations for President Obama. And you might expect her latest book to be about geopolitics or more about the problem of genocide. But her book is a memoir, and it's really personal. So she goes back to those first parts of her story, being born in Ireland, coming to the United States at age 9. And for all Samantha Power has accomplished in her life, you would think she would have had some idea about her future in those early days. But she didn't. She was just looking for a way into her new culture.
When I moved to America as an immigrant when I was 9, I had long red hair, a thick Dublin accent, lots of freckles, the wrong clothes, tartan skirt, patent leather shoes from my Irish Catholic school, and no American clothing. But I realized really quickly that sports was a way to fit in. And so I became the master of the rules of baseball and the statistics, RBIs and ERAs, and I learned the history. And when I got to college, I joined a group of my classmates co-hosting a radio show on sports. I did play-by-play and color commentary for the Yale men's basketball and women's basketball teams. And this was a safe space.
A positively sweltering day at Atlanta's Fulton County Stadium, game 2 of the weekend series between the Giants and the Braves, right-hander Don Robinson.
So, there I am in Atlanta, Georgia, where I'd gone to high school, back for the summer after this first year, apolitical, and tasked by the sports editor to help cut the sports highlights on the Atlanta Braves game against the San Francisco Giants that was being played that day. When there's a home run or an error or a funny dance in the stands, you write that down and then put the time in the videotape so you can go back easily to cut the highlights. And as I'm doing that with great earnestness and conviction, on the CBS feed comes footage from Beijing, China. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I think I knew that there had been protests in China led by students my age at the time, for many weeks prior to that point.
As the world watches and listens in horror, the peaceful pro-democracy demonstration in China comes to a violent and bloody end, crushed by waves of Chinese military forces.
But what I ended up looking at was footage from the very day that the Chinese government decided to eradicate those protests.
This is a CBS News special report. From CBS News headquarters in New York, here is Dan Rather.
So what I actually saw was Chinese tanks barreling toward where the CBS camera person was positioned in Tiananmen Square and watched kids get on their bicycles and trying to stay ahead of the tanks and pick up wounded people, and tanks just showing no regard for who or what was in front of them. And I was just frozen in place. It was as graphic and devastating a look at might makes right that a person could get. Just to see how torn up I was about what I was witnessing was an insight into myself. Here I was, just heartbroken for these kids. And I didn't say to myself, okay, that's it. I'm done with sports. One day I'm going to stand up to China, the United Nations. But I did just notice in myself that some change had happened, kind of shaking me out of the sense that my life could be separated from the fates of people far away. I was resolved to learn more. And when I went back to campus after this exposure to what was happening in China. I subscribed to the New York Times. I made myself slog through it with pencil and pen and highlighter in hand, circling the names of leaders and key historic events. And the fate of those kids was something I just continued to track. It was like my gateway into this world that then would become my professional and my personal life for decades to come.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a conversation with Samantha Power. Her book is called The Education of an Idealist. And the thing that got her writing was this feeling she had, feeling small.
I think the roots of it lie in the feeling of being small, next to the scale of problems that are confronting us all. When I realized that this was how I was feeling and this was how many people were feeling, I thought, you know, I need to kind of lift the hood on some of the experiences that I've just had for myself, as well as for people who might be interested in reading about it, to show that people can make a difference, that individuals can make a difference, that individuals can comprise groups that make a difference, that citizen action can matter. And that was very much my experience of serving within the Obama administration. But I realized I had multiple examples also from having been a journalist, an activist from the outside, and that the fuel for people to get up and march today or to vote or to register others to vote or to go into public service or to run for office or to give some of their money away for causes they believe in, the fuel is hope. And so that was that is the root, I think, of deciding to write something that went back over these years where I'd been active in trying to inject human rights concerns into American foreign policy from the outside and then from the inside. It was a desire not only to tell my story, where it might have made a modest impact here or there, but really to also expose a kind of integrity of purpose that I was really struck by inside the government at a time when, of course, Trump was attacking the deep state, but people have a lot of skepticism about public service and about government, about the utility of diplomacy, but just in general, whether they should believe in politics. I felt I had a story to tell that would generate, you know, more belief and a little more enthusiasm to give it a go. And I thought, if I can actually describe this, not in this black and white kind of heroes and villains terms, but in the complexity in which you live it and situate readers also in the shoes of someone who's trying to make a difference, maybe bumping their head against the wall on one day, but also seeing some results on another day, that can be inspiring.
Yeah. Let's talk about your mom. You write about her. You describe her in the book as the person you've always admired most in the world. And you explain that she really sort of came of age as a person at a time when most women in Ireland were not part of the workforce. What influence did she have on your perspective on the world and the way you were growing up?
I think that seeing the obstacles that she encountered as a woman trying to become a doctor and the number of barriers that were put in her way. And she's 76 now, so that gives you a sense of her generationally, but she grew up in Ireland, not in America. And Ireland lagged behind, particularly given the role of the church on birth control, on abortion, on divorce, you name it. In those years, there were strong biases against women going forth into the workplace and pursuing their dreams in the way that she wanted to and knew from a very young age. She just wanted to care for patients. That was what she wanted. That's what she's doing now at the height of the corona pandemic in New York. And above all, I think because I'd seen my mother blaze a trail on her own, I didn't, until I got to the White House, really understand how important solidarity among women is in male-dominated environments. And then the other thing is she just is the most empathetic person I've ever met. I mean, I tell the story in the book, I think of just how she would bring home the stories of her patients.
Yeah.
And I literally felt like they were members of our extended family. I mean, just the level of detail about their failed romance or their effort to have children or what one of their kids had done in his Little League game. And just that way of listening and seeing kind of the universe in a grain of sand, I think, just the small details that my mother cherished, maybe that fed my interest in storytelling and my desire to hear from people who are affected by decision-making, right? Rather than just assuming that if your intentions are good, that things are going to land in the way that you hope. I think to be that curious and to try to extract those details. I tried to continue to do that even when I was UN ambassador.
Let's talk about, I'm trying to imagine the stories that you must have heard at Hartigan's. This is a pub that when you lived in Ireland with your, when your mother and your father were together, a pub some 10 minutes away from where you lived in Dublin. Tell me about Hartigan's, if you would, and then your father, of course, because he holds forth there, and he's an important figure there in that pub. You describe him as an epic figure.
Yes, I mean, my mother was off pursuing her medical degree and then caring for patients as a resident. My father, who had been initially really supportive of my mother's pursuit of her lifelong dream to become a doctor, I think began to feel a little bit left out in the cold. Mm. And my father found refuge in the pub. Mm. So that meant that I found refuge in the pub because I was my father's sidekick. And he would go to Hartigan's pub most days, certainly all day, both weekend days. I would proudly enter at his side, Robin to his Batman, I guess, and he'd buy me a Fanta and some peanuts, Planters peanuts, and I would park myself in a kind of dank basement, read my Enid Blyton mystery novels or my Hardy Boys or whatever I was up to on a given day, and content myself. And there were other kids of other bar patrons, so I had a close network of friends there, again, particularly at the weekend. And, you know, you, for a child, the universe shrinks, and mine certainly shrank, but became very relational. It was, I'm with my dad. My dad wants me here. He wants me nearby, was the story I told myself. Mm-hmm. But the drink fundamentally really did come to take over his life. And as a result, my mother ended up leaving him. She met a fellow Dublin doctor, kidney doctor, at the hospital where she was working. And the two of them wanted to divorce their spouses and get married. But there was no divorce in Ireland at that time. And the decision they made was to come to America. That is my mother and my now stepfather. And so they decided that because my dad was drinking so much, that it was really important that my mother get custody of my younger brother and myself. And she got custody. And a few years after we arrived, we very, very surprisingly to me, got word that my father had died. And that in the interim between our departure and when he died, when I was 14, the drink had become his full-time vocation. And it had really... He'd sort of, you know, driven people away. There was no one like me around for him to be trying to hold it together for.
Yeah.
And he died very, very isolated, and just in horrible, horrible health. And I, that's something that I carried with me, still carry with me, but just a sense of if we'd been there, if we'd stayed, you know, I carried that guilt and didn't even really process just how much guilt I was carrying or how much of a exaggerated sense of responsibility I was carrying until I was in my 30s. And of course, as is often the case, it's when you continue to screw up your romantic life that you begin to delve deeply into these earlier chapters of your life. And it was out of that urgency or that exigency that I finally began to look back and think, okay, is this reasonable? to feel this badly mm-hmm. about something that when you're 9, 10, 11, 12 years old is really a bit beyond your reach.
I want to ask you about, there's so many figures that influenced the way you you were thinking, came to think and act on in your career. One that I wanted to ask you about was Mort Abramowitz. You get out of college, you take up this internship at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. This is where you meet him. And it seems like, at least in those early days, some of the things that he was saying were really influential on your thinking. One of the things he mentions is what we do depends on one thing, the people. And another thing that he kept saying, you said he was sort of guided by this question, will it do any good? Talk a little bit about his influence on the way you were thinking about this, because he had this sense of humility and self-criticism. He seemed like a really charming but also pretty direct guy.
I think it was the humility that I found most shocking. I mean, here I am in my early 20s interning with this guy. He's been U.S. ambassador to Turkey at the time of the Kurdish crisis and was pivotal in convincing James Baker, Secretary of State James Baker, and George H.W. Bush to protect the Kurds of northern Iraq in the wake of the first Persian Gulf War. Before that, Mort had been ambassador to Thailand. Mm. I mean, he had done so much in the world, and yet there was no such thing as a dumb question or an impertinent question. Mm. He didn't trust his own grasp of geopolitics unless and until it had been stress tested by people from other countries, but also people who'd be most likely to hold contrary views. You know, he'd really want to hear what the devil's advocate view would be and then would land somewhere else. So I think that was what he cultivated in people around him. I also think beautifully as a mentor and of a person of a different generation. I mean, he's in his mid-80s now. But he was wonderfully unhierarchical. His interest, when he had been in the U.S. Foreign Service, I gather, but also at that time he was the president of the Carnegie Endowment, a Washington think tank, and he just didn't care where an idea came from. If it seemed like something that could be practically effective.
Yeah. One of the things that you that sort of is going on in the book in some way is that it looks like this dialogue that comes up in your life in the book between the old early idealistic Samantha Power and the current one, the one, you know, with a position in government, with years of reality having maybe tempered some of that idealism. And I wanted to ask you about a good part of the book also is your work, of course, as a foreign correspondent and covering the Bosnian War. And it was during this time, you say that the more you learned about what was happening in that region, you say you seemed, this is how you put it, unable to contain your emotions or modulate your judgments. And you say if the subject of Bosnia would come up, for example, and people would say, oh, there's a civil war going on. You say it's not a civil war. This is a genocide. Describe the part of this dialogue that's going on there compared to where you sort of ended up. Do you know what I mean? Like that sort of give and take, who you were then and how you might respond a little bit later in this story.
Yes, it's a great question. I think that what happens as any of us really get older and just have more encounters with more people is that we, if we're lucky, we start to be better at seeing ourselves in the mirror and having been recipients of other people's advocacy or judgment, we know how it feels. It doesn't feel good. It doesn't make you want to agree with somebody when you feel judged by that person. And I guess one through line in my work is I was always pretty good, I think, at looking to see whether what I was doing was having an effect. I mean, to a fault, like when I was a cub reporter in Bosnia, I was, why aren't my articles moving President Clinton? Why isn't he, you know, it's ridiculous in retrospect, but that was a youthful version of it. But it's in a way, since I was motivated to get into journalism by what was happening in the war in Bosnia, it was kind of good that I was at least asking that. I mean, again, it's embarrassing, but it was kind of good compared to what could have come to motivate me, which is, where am I appearing in the paper? Hmm. You know, if I was motivated to go to Bosnia by what was happening to the Bosnians, then it was good that I was curious about the extent to which what I and my colleagues were writing was influencing the humanitarian response or lack thereof. So it was the right question, even if my expectations were out of whack. And I think as I got older and sort of got around a little bit, just my own experience of other people coming at me hard in a way that sounded sanctimonious or all-knowing or uncurious, it was never all that effective with me. And so it didn't take me that long to realize that it was unlikely that if I acted in those ways, that I would also be setting my cause back. And so it doesn't mean that I always succeeded in channeling, you know, whatever emotions I might've been feeling, particularly on Syria, where it really did just feel as if we were treading water. But by and large, it just gets to sort of the core of empathy, is put yourself in the shoes of others. And what is likely to be most effective in bringing that individual or that group of people to your side. And this helps in diplomacy too, of course. I could have, with the Russian ambassador, who I had a really difficult relationship with because of the actions of Putin's government in Ukraine, in Aleppo, Syria, and then ultimately in the U.S. election in 2016, that relationship could have spiraled downward into nothingness. But instead, I tried to ask myself, okay, what would it be like to have placed your hopes in U.S.-Russian cooperation, normalization, to have believed in Russia's own democratization, and then to have that system hijacked by a nationalist who was prepared, like Putin, who was prepared to resort to just about any tactic? That must suck. So let me instead try to work with this person who has a job to do, just like I do, representing his country and following the instructions of his president. But maybe together we can pull water from a stone by remembering that we're also individuals who occupy these roles.
Samantha Power. These days, she teaches at the Harvard Law School and the Harvard Kennedy School. We're talking about her new memoir, The Education of an Idealist. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Weekends are kind of a toss-up. Sometimes we're productive, and other times we're lazy. But no matter where you are on the scale of busyness, KUER is ready to spend the day with you. On your smart speaker, just tell it to play KUER. And
wait, don't tell me the
This is All Things Considered from NPR.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Have a laugh, stay informed, and ultimately enjoy your weekend with NPR Utah. Tell your smart speaker to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Samantha Power was going to be a sports reporter. The Samantha Power who was a war correspondent, who won a Pulitzer Prize, the Samantha Power who was the U.S. ambassador to the UN, wanted to cover sports at some point in her life. Now, she didn't, of course, and in her new memoir, she explains what changed. The book is called The Education of an Idealist. I wanted to talk about your relationship with Barack Obama, which you write about obviously in the book. And I was struck by this conversation you write about. It's your first real deep conversation. It's a dinner that you have with then-Senator Barack Obama. He comes in and says, look, I don't have a lot of time. Maybe this will be 45 minutes. You decide I better not order the appetizers. And it ends up being, you close the place basically, it ends up being like a 4-hour conversation. And I was really struck by the interchange, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about the exchange that you had with him, because it was interesting how specific his questions were, how in some ways kind of personal the questions were. I think you talk about in the book how he often filters things through a personal lens. Would you just talk about that experience, that dinner? What was he trying to get, and what was the connection, as you understand it, do you think, between you two?
At that time, Barack Obama was newly elected to the U.S. Senate, so he'd been catapulted onto the national stage through his famous convention speech, in which he said there are no blue states or red states, there's only the United States. I had watched that speech. I've been as swept away as everybody. Mm. In some ways, he had already been catapulted onto the international stage. And he took office just after John Kerry was defeated and George W. Bush had been elected to a second term. So if you were a Democrat, there weren't a ton of bright spots, and he was one. And here I was having dinner with him. He'd read the book, A Problem from Hell, that I had done on genocide, and was reaching out not just to me, but to dozens of people who had written and thought about American foreign policy in the hopes that at this time where the flag bearer, John Kerry, had just lost his election and the Democratic Party was a little bit at sea, that he, this first-term U.S. senator, could play a role in helping define what a smart, tough, and humane foreign policy could look like. And so that was the spirit in which he was meeting with me, as he wanted to see whether there was overlap in our thinking or see whether I had ideas, I think, for what might constitute, different kind of planks to what he was working on and what ultimately he hoped to bring to the party and bring to national politics. So that was the context. But like you said, weirdly, we sat down and it was all biography. It was all, where do you come from?
Yeah.
What do you mean, Ireland? And so I think what I can deduce now, at least looking back, is that this is how Barack Obama learns. And what really struck me was, on the substance of what we discussed about foreign policy, was how unwedded he was to any of the shibboleths or the kind of conventional constraints in thinking about American foreign policy. You know, it wasn't like, okay, because we've always done it this way, that means, you know, so he might have asked me about whether we needed to create new international institutions, if the UN had kind of done its time, and so talking about that, or making links between nation building and the challenges that people like Barack Obama and others had in even trying to strengthen the resilience of inner city communities. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on one level, him asking, well, wait, we think we can do this in Iraq and we can't do it in downtown Chicago. Yeah. How on earth would that work exactly? Like, what's the best? Give me the best case account of how we can make a difference in places where we don't speak the language and are mistrusted just by virtue of our foreign identities. And so it was just this kind of, you know, unbounded, free-flowing, deeply curious, but also kind of irreverent take on a lot of different dimensions to foreign policy. And for me, it was refreshing because I thought, wow, so the fact that this individual who famously opposed the Iraq war at a time when, you know, many, many Democrats were rushing to embrace it, in a relative wake of 9/11, mm-hmm. where it was seen as a show of patriotism to support this war, I thought to myself, as I heard him, I thought, okay, that wasn't a one-off. That's reflective of taking these problems as they come and not being pre-wedded to the, again, a herd mentality or to groupthink or to what polite company says you should be for. And I thought, wow, that independence of mind is pretty unusual in this town. And so as I was at the dinner, I was thinking to myself, I was by then a professor at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and I loved my life. And I'd actually just gotten season tickets to the Red Sox, having been on a waiting list for a really long time. And so part of me is thinking, I love my life. Part of me is thinking, this guy is really unusual. He had been adamant in the dinner that he was not going to run for president, I would note.
Right.
He would subsequently retract that. But so it wasn't like I thought I was riding some starship into another galaxy. I just thought to myself, this could be really interesting and fruitful, and I could grow and understand the way the Senate worked. And so by the end of this long dinner, as the car is idling, his car is idling outside the restaurant, I finally get up my courage to say, how would you feel if I came down and worked with you in the Senate office? And he's like, what? I don't have any jobs. I don't have any money to. And I said, oh, it's okay. You know, I can just come down and help you think through some of these ideas. And it's one of the more spontaneous things I've ever done. And of course, a lot has come out of it, including my marriage, my two children, because I met my husband on the Obama campaign.
Yeah.
So it's for me, that's one of the great lessons of the education of an idealist is just, if it's on your mind, just take the plunge. You know, the worst thing they could do is say no.
Yeah.
Which I definitely thought he would do, but yeah. In the end I was able to go and work with him.
That brings us to this moment. Fast forward a few years from that September, 2013. And you write about the experience of this conversation, this dialogue, this debate that's going on, of course, within the Obama administration about what to do about Syria. And there's this story you tell. It's a Saturday, September in 2013. You're in a diner. This is in New York City. You're with your family and you get this call. Would you take us through this moment?
Yes. So this occurs in the wake of Bashar al-Assad's government gassing 1,400 Syrians, including more than 400 kids, gassing and killing them.
Yeah.
And initially, as some may recall, President Obama came out and said, okay, you've crossed the red line. We're going to meet this attack with the only tool left in our toolbox that we've not deployed, which is limited airstrikes against facilities that were involved in some way with this monstrous attack. And he had said to the American people, look, we have to do this because doing other things like the International Criminal Court or sanctions, none of that will prevent Assad from striking again. And we have an interest not only in preventing massacres like this, but also in ensuring that people don't use chemical weapons. We had finally gotten that norm enforced and respected. And now here's Assad coming along after 25 years in which no chemical weapons had been used and letting the genie out of the bottle in this devastating way. And so he was out there for in favor of the use of force and was prepared to go ahead. The UN had some inspectors on the ground, and the UN kept those inspectors on the ground, which delayed action, military action. And in addition, David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Britain, asked Obama for a slight delay so he could get support from his parliament, support which was, it turned out, was not forthcoming. Mm. So after a week or 10 days had passed, the public revulsion at what Assad had done began to give way to real concern about what U.S. military action in the Middle East would look like again. And Obama decided to go to Congress because of this ambivalence. He thought, okay, if I'm going to do this, let me do it with the backing at least of the legislature. So let me seek an authorization to use military force. That way Assad will know that he can't just bluff or outlast us. We will be, you know, we will follow through on my promise. And Congress, Democrats and Republicans alike, wanted nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
So when Obama called me in the diner, he was calling because I had just begun to sit down for negotiations with the Russian ambassador about potentially using the threat of military action to disable Syria's chemical weapons program. And this was both potentially a very important thing to happen on the ground because it would mean that the very weapons that had been used in this attack would no longer be available. Other weapons would be, mind you, but at least to get rid of the chemical weapons stockpile would be good for the world, good for the Syrians. But it was also important for Obama because he had gone to Congress. Congress had effectively undermined his authority as commander-in-chief by effectively saying no.
Yeah.
And this was the only show in town. And so I was just a few weeks into my job as U.S. ambassador to the U.N. I was sitting with my kids. And so here it's the switchboard from the White House. It was the first time the president had called me since I was in my job. And he, you know, of course, was concerned that I would execute this really, really difficult show of brinksmanship, really, with Russia, that I would be sufficiently forceful that we would get this program dismantled, but not too forceful that this negotiation would blow up. And so I stepped outside the diner. My son was hurling scrambled eggs at my daughter. My husband was oblivious to anything happening. And I stepped out onto the sidewalk, my close protection detail around me huddling. I was, you know, very new to the job and not at all used to having people in my space all the time. And the president said, "Sam, you know, how you doing?" And I'm like, all right, what's up? Like, why are you calling me?" And he said, "I just wanted, you're going to do a great job. I have the utmost confidence in you, but," and you're thinking, okay, this is not where we're looking for a but, mm-hmm. but he said, I don't want you to overshoot the runway."
Yeah.
Meaning don't overdo it, right? We need to get this chemical weapons program destroyed. We don't have another military option. This is the play. And I was about to say, "Yes, sir." And then he said, but,
Don't undershoot the runway either. Yeah.
Don't undershoot the runways, meaning don't ask for too little such that this isn't enforceable. And so I'm there. Just, part of me is thinking, where exactly is the runway? Mm-hmm. You know, I've arrived a matter of weeks before. I've only just met my Russian counterpart for the first time. And but anyway, we went forth and salvaged this chemical weapons destruction operation, which would prove intrinsically important, but also important for when ISIS came on the scene, because those weapons, those stockpiles would have been probably stockpiles that ISIS could have gotten their hands on had they not been destroyed. But this chapter, this sequence ended up being, I think it's fair to say, a net negative for the credibility of US-led negotiations. There was a feeling that Congress would not give Obama what he wanted, that the U.S. was had made promises that it couldn't keep, and so forth. So again, I think we did as much good as we could given the circumstance we found ourselves in, but it was not a perfect chapter in American foreign policy, because we had staked out publicly, we had made a set of commitments about what we were going to do, and we're not able to follow through on that.
I just wanted to get you to mention, though, your sense of possibly frustration here. Obviously, you're pushing for stronger action in Syria. There are moments that you reveal in the book where the president would say to you, "Look, we've all read your book, Samantha," like to say, we get it. And then there are other times when he would turn around and want your input. So there's this back and forth. There's this question of why, in principle, you didn't resign over inaction in Syria. That question does come up. And you also write about having been inspired in the past, in your earlier days as you know, as a journalist and as a college student, seeing people resigning in principle over these kinds of things. And the question comes up, why you didn't. Will you talk about this part of that?
I think the questions of me were entirely fair. I think they're fair of any public official, frankly, but especially fair because, as you said, I had valorized those individuals who had resigned over the bombing of Cambodia in my writing, as well as a number of State Department officials who resigned over the Bush administration, first Bush administration, and then the Clinton administration's response to the atrocities in Bosnia, or limited response, the limits of that response initially. So I thought it was John McCain asked for my resignation. A number of major newspapers called for my resignation. But I think that if I were looking only at Syria, and if that had been my job, right, to my only job, then I really would have had to think hard about it. Not because I felt President Obama wasn't listening to me, not because I felt there was some obvious right answer, but it was just day to day, the grinding horror of what was being inflicted on individuals and my own inability to formulate something that was going to make a material difference. I think that dissonance, which was with me throughout my time in government, might well have been enough to push me over the edge. But that wasn't my only job. Yeah. And even on Syria, I was able to work with the Russian ambassador to get Syrian political prisoners out of jail. I was able to get a humanitarian resolution through the Security Council that provided food to several hundred thousand people in northern Syria who had not been reached. And that was drawing on the relationship I built with the Russian ambassador. I launched a campaign to get female political prisoners out of jail, and we got 16 out of 20 of those women out of jail. I was helping Obama mobilize the Ebola coalition that would end an epidemic that was supposed to infect 1.4 million people and ended up, we together backing the efforts of people in those African countries, ended up bending the curve far, far sooner. And the deaths ended up being only in the tens of thousands, too many, but way, way fewer than if we hadn't together been pooling our efforts to mobilize a big global coalition of the kind that I wish we had currently on the pandemic. But my point is, and I could go on, I could also offer other examples of frustrations and, you know, a sense of disappointment with my own ability to be effective. It's a balance of a lot of different considerations and variables, but I felt that the people who were understandably judging me were looking only at Syria. And I thought about people in a country that most Americans don't spend a lot of time thinking about, the Central African Republic, where I had turned U.S. Policy around to where we supported the deployment of peacekeepers who were keeping civilians safe across the country. I was thinking to myself, would my successor, would they necessarily care about the Central African Republic, or would they? I'd been there four times and felt I had the lay of the land. And so you could say that this is all rationalization, but to me, it's about trying to do what I talked about earlier in our discussion, which is measure. Is something working, and measure across the full scope of issues that I had the privilege to work on. And I also, of course, had to weigh that against what good would it do to resign for anybody. It might make me feel good for 5 minutes, but it certainly wasn't going to make President Obama, do things differently in Syria. It didn't seem, and it wasn't going to leave me in a position back in my academic life to be working on the fates of people felled by disease or people locked up for their views, or I wasn't going to be supporting the anti-corruption efforts that I'd helped generate a big initiative on. So I just felt, on balance, the cost benefit was not did not lead me to think that resigning would be a good idea in net.
How diminished is American influence really right now? Because one of the things you mentioned, which is quite optimistic given what's going on right now, is that, this is how you put it in the book, the U.S. will remain the most important country in the world for decades to come. So why do you feel that way?
Well, you could come to that conclusion simply on the basis of looking at the power of America's military, or the size of America's economy, its buying power, its reach around the world. China's definitely going to give us a run for our money economically, and will soon become the largest economy in the world. But you can have influence whether it's positive or negative. And so, I think when the current president attacks journalists, it's very hard to measure, the extent to which other leaders are following his cue, or other leaders would have done that anyway, attack their own journalists or, arrested journalists. When Donald Trump invokes the need to deploy the military against largely peaceful protesters, and then you see other governments making the same threats, is that because other governments would do that anyway, or is that American influence in the world? It's hard to say. But I think what's clear is that Donald Trump has taken values and human rights out of American foreign policy and made it much more transactional. And it was never, of course, perfectly consistent when it came to human rights. It often disappointed in these regards. But it was still part of America's strength, I think, was the knowledge that oppressed people would have around the world, that we would at least rhetorically stand with them. That's gone. And it's become transactional in the sense that it doesn't seem, our foreign policy doesn't really seem rooted in advancing the medium-term interests, and never mind the long-term interests of the American people. It's very sort of short-termist, and that means that global threats, like pandemics, of course, but also like climate change, even terrorism and cyber threats, there isn't a kind of an approach that has this administration working with other countries, thinking about how we pool our resources, how we cooperate in more effective ways, given that these problems are outpacing our institutions. None of that is happening. And then the other dimension, I think, of what President Trump has done is he's really walked away from a core source of security for the American people, and that is our alliances. In some ways, just by having operated in the U.S. government, I came to see something that's so intuitive, but it took me, I think, being a U.S. official to really appreciate it, which is that geopolitics is a lot like life. In life, it's good to have friends. It's good to be respected. You tend to be more influential if you are respected. You tend to be able to rely on people in a pinch when you have friends. Geopolitics is like that. And if you view it instead as something where you can just show up and get what you want when you want it, you are likely to be very disappointed. And we need in the coming years, in the wake of Donald Trump, whenever that comes, to return to first principles, you know, to recognizing that the best source of our leadership internationally is whether our democracy is working at home. You know, nothing has damaged U.S. leadership like the mishandling of the pandemic. The things that we do effectively within our own borders showcase what America is and what America can offer other countries. But we also need to get back to first principles in terms of rebuilding those friendships that are in some peril right now. You see some of our closest allies really hedging, not sure whether they can count on the faithfulness of the United States, and restoring that confidence is going to be extremely challenging. But if we do, and if, again, this is the tallest order of all, is getting our democracy to work more effectively given our polarization and our gridlock, but if we are in a position as a democracy that becomes more functional to gather the democracies of the world together, we will have far more influence even than a China acting much more aggressively beyond its borders. We have shared values, we have shared security interests, and there are far more people in the world, I think, who would be prepared to stand for those values if they knew that the United States would have their back. That's not something they know right now, but that's something they're still desperate to hear.
Final quick question. Let's say a President-elect Joe Biden approached you for Secretary of State, what would you say?
I am 24/7 right now on the Biden fundraising, the voter registration drives. I am completely in the present. And I know that sounds like a classic dodge, but that feels about as far away in the distance as my kids graduating from high school or something. It feels really, there's so much that has to happen between now and then. And I do think one of the beautiful dimensions of this campaign that Biden is running and all the people who are supporting him, Republican and Democrat alike, is how few people are, you know, the normal scrum is that people are sort of say, oh, we're not focused on jobs, but in their minds, they're making their lists, you know. Yeah. I don't think anybody, I haven't talked to anybody who I'm close to, I feel like I could pry that out of, who's thinking even a minute in those ways. It's just so urgent. It's so damaging every day that we have to live through another day under this president, damaging to our standing in the world, but above all damaging to the interests of the American people and the welfare of the American people at home. And I think what is terrifying and motivating is if this 4 years is what Donald Trump is like when he has to be accountable to the voters, what will he be like when he is no longer accountable, when he's in a second term and the guardrails have really come down? And so that's my focus.
Ambassador Power, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Samantha Power. She was the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, serving under President Barack Obama. Her new memoir is called The Education of an Idealist. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Tway, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.